Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening.
We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont.
Private equity, a term rarely used 20 years ago, has grown to become a significant artery in the investment and real-life worlds as PE firms extend their size, their reach, and their ownership of corporations around the world. This has far-reaching ramifications, from leading to a rethink of asset classes available for investors to shrinking stock market listings, greater choice for entrepreneurs selling their businesses, to the very real experience of employees at those firms and more. Over the next few weeks, the Money Maze podcast is going to try to dig down to demystify this world. And to do this, we're going to talk to some of the top PE operators, Goldman Sachs, KKR, Bain Capital, CD&R, Permira, and Schroders Capital. And today, to help me understand one corner of this investment chessboard, we're going to start with Goldman Sachs UK-listed Petershill Group, who have raised over $10 billion of private capital since 2007 and achieved a 24% gross IRR per annum investing in the PE and alternatives businesses. And to do that, I'm delighted to have Robert Hamilton Kelly, co-head of Petershill Group, with me today. So Robert, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you, Simon. Pleasure to be here.
We were due to have this meeting in person in London, and you have been struck with COVID. You are in New York. You might be the first guest that I've actually interviewed whilst they have COVID. When I said that if you didn't appear today, you'd lose your slot, I was only joking.
The pandemic hopefully is nearing the end, but COVID is here to stay, so I'm living proof of that.
Over the years, I've been a client of Goldman. I've competed against Goldman, and they've always been a byword for successful execution across multiple disciplines. But tell me, did you spend your teenage years dreaming of working at Goldman Sachs?
Given I'm based in the US, I should probably say yes, because I think in the US, people tend to grow up with a more central view on what they're going to do in terms of their careers. But growing up in England and through the English system, and reading history at Oxford, you ultimately get more of a training in ways to think and the skill sets that come with that, and less the actual toolkit that you'd use in corporate finance or private equity investing. I had a broader view of what I was going to do growing up, passed through everything from being a doctor, as many of my family are, to other more esoteric careers, but as you say, ended up in corporate finance and then ultimately private equity investing from then. But it was really a case of being curious, finding out what you enjoy, finding out what hopefully you have your best attributes in, and then following the path that that leads to.
We had breakfast in New York where you were able to explain the business to me, which was very helpful. But when I looked at your LinkedIn profile, I saw you left Oxford in 06 and joined Goldman's in 09. And as they say at Bank Tube Station, mind the gap. What happened in those intervening years?
I read History at Oxford, and then I went to work at a boutique investment bank, Gleacher Chatcock, in London, where I focused initially on broad corporate finance M&A, and then ended up specializing a little bit in special situations through the 08 crisis, which was obviously a fantastic learning experience, being close to companies in significant stress through that period. I was probably, when I turned up there, a terrible day one analyst. I read history at university. I don't think I'd opened an Excel document in my life. I'd probably used email two or three times. And so I had a steep learning curve there, but very much enjoyed it. I think some of the benefits you get in life from actually being an outsider, recognizing that you need to play catch up or learn more, is you put in that extra work to read around the subject. I do an hour's work before going into the office in the morning to try and bridge that gap, as you mentioned. And you soon find actually in our industry that things repeat themselves enough that you learn pretty quickly. So I remember reading about things like helicopter money in Japan in 06 and 07, and pretty soon you're in a world in 07, 08 where you start seeing quantitative easing and those things playing through. It was a very good place to learn the trade and to get up to speed and to hone your tools.
So let's jump to Goldman's and let's jump specifically to Peter's Hill. How did Peter's Hill as a business come about?
Goldman already had a very strong relationship with alternatives businesses on the banking and on the securities side. And at the time that Peter's Hill started in 07, the alternatives industry as a whole was $2 or $3 trillion. Total. It's closer to $13 trillion today. And what was very clear to the firm was it was a space that was set to grow pretty robustly over the next decade, where Goldman had good relationships with founders, but where there weren't that many firms or investors willing to put capital into the businesses of these firms to help them grow and develop their franchise over time. It was really a pretty simple premise that this is a fast-growing industry that's highly cash flow positive and has strong margins, but has a lack of growth capital coming in to fund the expansion of these businesses over time. The Goldman network could be helpful to these businesses and the management teams as they expand and develop their footprint over time. And so Peter's Hill was a group set up to address that opportunity set, and so raised external capital first in 07 to go partner with alternatives firms as they go through that growth journey.
I refer to GPs and LPs, general partners and limited partners, but just for the sake of being clear, explain, please, those two terms.
The LP are the clients of an asset management firm or an alternative asset management firm. So the LPs are providing capital into the funds that the management companies manage. The management companies are the shorthand referred to as the GPs, but that is the firm itself. So when we think about what Peter's Hill does as a business, we don't provide LP capital. We're not a client of these businesses. We are a partner and shareholder in these businesses. So we will come in, provide growth capital to the businesses. It's typically people raising capital. It's not people cashing out and taking money off the table. They're raising capital into the business to help develop new products or expand their geographic footprint or bring in new teams to expand, again, the GP or the management company of the business.
And if you're standing at Harvard Business School giving a case study on this, what essentially, if you reduce it, is the business case?
There's two aspects to it. First is obviously, what's the business case from our perspective, from the Peter's Hill perspective going into these firms? And then you've also got to consider it from the management teams who run these businesses, who are taking in the partnership capital from us. When we look at it, it starts with the quality of these businesses. So if you think about an alternative asset management firm, they are some of the most exciting businesses on earth, period. And that's because they raise long-term capital, particularly private capital firms will raise 10, 12-year funds. That means the capital they raise from their clients is locked up and pays fees for a decade plus. So you have long-term visibility on the revenues of the business. They are businesses with good margins and free cash flow conversion. So that revenue converts into real cash profits. And they sit in a sector that's been growing at more than 10% a year every year for the last 20 years. extraordinary sector to be part of. The business models themselves are very stable and cash flow positive. From an investment perspective, it's hard to think of better businesses that have those characteristics.
I think your sweet spot is what you might term the mid-market private firms, 2 to 15 billion of assets under management. So they've already been established. Something makes them want to reach out to you for more capital. What typically are those factors or the events that have led to that?
Having said these are extraordinary businesses, it raises the question of why those partners would want to bring someone into that business model. The growth that we've just talked about in terms of the overall sector has played through to these firms, and these mid-market firms are some of the strongest growing firms. And while these businesses aren't very capital intensive, they do require capital. There may be capital to go seed or launch a new product, launch a new investment team or bring in a team, or to put more capital in your own existing products so you're aligned with your underlying clients as well. So as these firms have grown, the requirement for more and more balance sheet capital, if you like, has increased. And so our transactions do two things. One, they bring in that balance sheet capital. It means they're not just reliant on the individual partners putting in their individual capital anymore. They have a institutionalized balance sheet to go and grow the firm with. And that's very important. And the other aspect is, if you think about it from many of these firms, these are very talented individuals with deep knowledge in their investment space. But in most cases, it's the first time they've run a multi-billion dollar alternative asset management firm. It's the first time they've thought about going from just being a private equity firm to also having a credit product or a structured equity product. Or it might be the first time that they've expanded geographically. Within Peters Hill, we have executed over 40 transactions to date. So we've been in over 40 firms as they've gone through these transition points, which means we have the pattern recognition, the satellite imagery, and can really be the tip of the spear for these firms and the management teams as they think through some of those developments over their journey.
And how often does a founder or an early investor want to move on and move out, and that's the trigger?
It is pretty rare. It certainly happens. A number of our partnerships, part of the capital may be buying out a departed founder or one partner amongst several. But the vast majority are really around firms creating balance sheet capital and using that capital to go develop their business going forward. Having said that, where you do have a firm with a departed partner, maybe you had four or five partners and one of them doesn't see eye to eye with the others anymore, that's a pretty good motivation as well, because it cleans up the partnership structure or the capital structure of the firm and allows the remaining partners to go and drive business development from there.
There's been this multi-decade explosion in alternative assets, private equity being part, but not all of it, and we'll come to the non-PE parts in a minute. And the cynics will say super cheap money, courtesy of central bank largesse, the game's changing, or potentially has already started changing. What do you think are the drivers that keep PE as a growth industry, even against the tide of rising interest rates?
The growth aspect is really both PE and across different areas of alternatives as well. You've clearly seen a similar pattern in private credit, and private real estate, and infrastructure, and other areas. There are three key themes that drive a lot of it. The first is a little structural, and people refer to this as companies staying private for longer, which I think is a neat shorthand, but it actually refers to a wider pattern of the way people want to run companies today. Companies staying private for longer implies they're just not IPOing so quickly. Sure, that happens. We also have firms that want to be held privately for longer, that want to stay away from the quarterly reporting cycle of the public market, that are very happy to continue to raise capital and grow privately. And I'd say that's a structural change. You can have a few different theories why it's happened. But at its core, it's possible today to go and raise multi-billion dollar fundraising rounds for private companies through technology, through systems, reaching out to private investors in a way that a decade or two ago, you could only organize that level of fundraising through a public market. That's a structural change that's allowed more private companies to raise more private capital. And so that's companies staying private for longer. The second aspect is around returns and perspectives of clients or LPs in the industry. So you have vast sums of capital that are held by pension funds on behalf of retirees or corporate pension funds or insurance companies or sovereign wealth funds. And for these groups, they have multi-decade horizons. They know they don't need that dollar of capital today. They don't need it tomorrow. They might not need it for 10 or 15 plus years. So what is important to them is that they compound capital above the rate of their liabilities. And for them, it can be more compelling to put money into private capital investment opportunities where they're getting an illiquidity premium, where they're getting a higher rate of return because of that illiquidity, rather than having to invest in the public market and be subject to the volatility of an investor who wants to buy a share today that he can sell tomorrow. It's really structural taking advantage of that opportunity set, given the duration of the capital of those underlying LPs or clients. This is a truism across areas of asset management. It is an area of investment that has higher fee structures than ETFs or other tools that you could use to invest in. That tends to attract talent. So you have a field of investment where you have some of the strongest investment talent drawn to because of that compensation model. And ultimately, we're a strong believer that talent produces strong results, strong management teams produce strong companies. If you follow the talent, that's also a good indicator of a strong investment field.
So Petershill have these minority ownerships in high margin business. And I have noted that minority ownership is higher in financial services than any other industry in the world, at least that I could find. Being a minority shareholder can be a double-edged sword, as we know. So tell me a little bit about how you think about that relationship when you start, and also what, as part of Goldman Sachs, that helps in the equation.
It does sit at the core of our philosophy in looking at these businesses. And as students of asset management, and particularly alternative asset management firms, we've consistently seen stronger outcomes where you are a non-control growth investor in these businesses, a minority, versus necessarily trying to take control of these businesses and tell the talent what to do. Many times these firms have been started by folks who have been in larger organizations. They've wanted to go start their own investment platform. When they're then competing for talent, they need to be able to pay their team market rates. If they pay them less than market rates, that team can move next door to a competitor, could go start its own firm. The alignment you get through not taking control, through leaving a lot of the ownership with the management teams, is pretty critical. Ownership equals alignment and incentivization to the long-term success of these businesses, which is why we typically come in and take, on average, 5 to 25% of these businesses and leave the rest of the economics with the management teams while providing them the capital to grow. That strategic relationship aspect is attractive to those firms because, again, they retain their independence and their alignment and their incentivization. But as management teams, they do want the help that comes through a strategic relationship with a larger organization. And the Goldman network is a very rich network of resources, knowledge share that we bring to bear with our partnership. When firms are going through their decision processes, are they going to expand into this field or not? Are they going to hire this new team or not? Are they going to expand geographically? We're helping them think through many of those questions with both the data sets, but also the resources that we have at Goldman.
I can see if you are one of those owners of an alternatives business, the prospect of having, on the right terms, Goldman's as a strategic partner is very attractive. So you must have a lot of folks coming to you with propositions as to why you should consider them. So let's talk about the deal making. What's the catalyst, given that you don't invest in a lot of entities?
You're right. We look at hundreds of opportunities a year. We typically transact in 3 to 6 on average. It's a very small sliver that makes it through the evaluation process. The simplest part, they have to be extraordinary businesses with very strong management teams. I can't put enough emphasis on that management team aspect. We start really with themes, so thinking about different types of businesses and asset classes that we think are going to be strong, not just over the next year or two, but over the next decade or two. And then we're looking on a fundamental business case and bottoms-up basis on each business, really dividing into a few different ways. The quality of management team and management execution, the development potential of that business ahead, the stability of that business and its partners, and then lastly, the quality of the investment product and the pricing power that that brings to the business. Those are our broad groups that we then factor into over time. But as I say, we're taking a pretty long-term view on these. And then we're also evaluating, where do we think we can be a good partner? Where do we think we can actually add value and help that firm develop? Because again, if it's just a one-way flow, then it's not going to be a successful partnership over a period of time.
Well, I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. We've got lots more to come. But a quick word on our new sponsor. Last year, I interviewed Gary Boom, CEO of Bordeaux Index. Wine is a great love of mine. And as he explained, Bordeaux Index has become a major disruptor in the way that wine is bought and sold and has sought to redefine the way a wine merchant works. I've been really impressed with their business and have been buying wine from them since that interview. So we're delighted that the Money Maze podcast is now also sponsored by Livetrade, their world-leading fine wine trading platform. Livetrade has changed the way fine wine is bought and sold worldwide. You can instantly buy and sell or place bids and offers on key wines from Bordeaux, Champagne, Italy and other world regions. Their two-way pricing offers guaranteed trading liquidity with no fees. So I recommend you have a look at their website, bordeauxindex.com/Livetrade. I listened to your results call a couple of weeks ago, and if I'm right, there are three particular sectors that you are focused on: tech, healthcare, and infrastructure. Does that mean that you exclude other areas, or how have you landed on those three particular silos?
That's a combination of, again, taking a long-term view of areas of disruption and value creation over the next decade plus, as well as taking a view on, for Petershill Partners, our listed company that we operate, where does that already have exposure and where do we want to add in new areas over time as well? Infrastructure clearly is a significant focus, particularly in the US, but really globally over the next decade plus, and very significant infrastructure spending is required. The private sector is likely to play a very important part of that. I think that has very strong tailwinds to it. Healthcare as well, significant ongoing spending, structural change in the way some of those industries are organized, and relatively light exposure for Petershill Partners to date. And then technology, notwithstanding, we're obviously going through a period of correction right now. If you ask me in 10 or 20 years' time, are enterprise software businesses still going to be a major part of the economy? I think very few people would doubt that. Firms who have very specialist expertise in that space will continue to be compelling businesses going forward.
That's the sector focus. I was surprised when I listened to the geographic focus that it's nearly 90% in the US. And that surprised me. I know you're located in the US, but why is it so skewed given global GDP's spread?
Global GDP is obviously more spread than that. If you look at the headquarters of global asset management firms, I suspect that actually does look relatively similar to us in terms of the footprint. A number of our US firms invest globally. So I think of Westbrook Partners in real estate, for example, invests in the US, invests in Europe, in Japan. And so that probably misses the fact that actually a number of those firms have more of a global footprint. But overall, when you look at the institutional alternative asset management firm industry, the predominance of capital, and particularly of established businesses with multi-year track records, are in the US and Europe. And so that's dictated a lot of that footprint to date.
Outside of PE and private credit, you are invested in the alternative asset management space, what we might refer to as hedge funds. When I left Morgan Stanley, I bought into a hedge fund business and was there for some time. And I wondered how you reflect on one of the characteristics of the alternative asset management business, which is that you tend to get some very brilliant individuals who can be somewhat idiosyncratic, certainly of strong opinion, and don't necessarily lend themselves to democratization.
and sometimes gets less charitably called the sun god mentality of some firms. That's certainly a factor for us. And we, over the last 5+ years, have made fewer absolute return investments and more private equity, private credit, private real estate. So our focus going forward is more on the private side. But I think the absolute return firms, a number of them are still incredibly well run. And when we've typically invested in them have been investments where the partners or the founders have looked to use that capital to broaden the footprint of the business. And so if we look at some of those fantastic partners we've got in the space, the likes of Caxton onwards, you look at the number of products they ran when we first partnered with them versus today, you've seen that they've gradually expanded the number of products they run, increased the diversity of their business, and increased the stability of those businesses over time. And that's the type of partnerships that historically we would form in that space.
If we look at one specific investment, and it's relevant because the interview that will follow you is going to be with Permira here in the UK, you're an investor in Permira. And I wondered, what was the overlap of interests that precipitated that investment?
It's a great example of a extraordinary business that had a great opportunity set over particularly the last 10 years, although obviously it has a much longer, more storied history. But given the expansion of their footprint, going just from their flagship fund, increasing in size, but also their growth fund, their credit business, that all requires more capital. When we partnered with them in early 2020, all of that capital came into the firm as a primary balance sheet investment. That then creates a great balance sheet for that business to go use as it continues its development and path forward. And takes the reliance off each individual partner putting in their percentage contribution to each fund. As a business, they know they are well funded and have that institutional balance sheet for the go forward. A great example of some of those trends that lead to those partnerships. And then on the why us, if you like, we'd known the partners in the firm for many years. They have a very strong relationship with Goldman Sachs. Could also appreciate on the strategic side what we could do to work with them and help their development over time. So a very natural partnership from that perspective.
Let's flip it the other way. I think you sold Claren Road to Carlyle. So you're a seller of a PE business to another PE firm. What precipitates that?
Found it was an investment in our first fund. We made 9 investments in that fund. We exited all of them. And even though it was no 7 vintage fund, we made investors over 2x money. So a very strong top decile return for that vintage. That's a good example of a theme that's very current today, which is there is much more M&A and consolidation in the alternatives industry today than there ever has been. You can look across a number of different firms. EQT in Europe has been very active in terms of making acquisitions. When we sold Claren Road, it was part of Carlyle in their path of growing assets, focused on being a public company, and that through acquisition, we sold as part of them taking overall control of that firm. And that's certainly something that we see from time to time. We recently just exited a real estate firm to Blue Owl in the US on a very similar thesis.
Let's talk about the listing. You decide to float. 90% of your business is with US firms. You sit in the US. You list in the UK. I just had a meeting with Peter Martin of Odi, and he just said, why did you list in the UK?
The UK stock market is unique in terms of its governance structures. We started the business in London, so we're very familiar, and part of our team is based in London. But the UK also has a governance structure for companies with external management. Peters Hill Partners is an independent company with a fully independent board, but it then outsources management of the company to Goldman Sachs Asset Management and the Peters Hill team. And that's a structure that doesn't really exist in the same way in many other markets. It doesn't really exist in the US in that form. The benefit for the company there is that rather than us IPOing the business, putting in new management team with limited experience or track, putting in a new management structure, the company can be run in the same way as it had been when it was owned by our private funds and still benefits from the strategic resources and the depth of resources from Goldman Sachs, but it can operate with public shareholders.
You list at £3.50. The price got down to £2.15 or so, which is when Will Campion said, we're going to New York, let's meet with Petershill and let's understand the story. So you've had this compression in valuation. I saw your earnings, as I said, and I actually was with one of your investors yesterday, Chris Dale of Kintbury Capital, which I'm invested in. You had good earnings. How are you reflecting on what's happened to the share price?
The fundamentals of the business are strong and has been reporting good earnings and a solid outlook. My mind actually tracks back to the early days of Petershill. And I think about when we raised our second fund in 2012, 2013. When we first started Petershill, we were the category creator. We were creating a new field. So we had to start every meeting by explaining what we did and why we did it and why it could be profitable. In the early days, it was tough to raise capital. So I think about our second fund, we raised $1.4 billion, took us the better part of 2 years, going and visiting investors all over the world. When we came back to raise our third fund, people knew who we were. We'd done what we said we'd do. We had put up a cash track record, and so we were more proven in terms of our track record. And we raised $2.5 billion in a matter of months. The reason I mention that is I think there's a strong parallel actually to our public company. In the field of public investors, we're the first business of our kind to list. We still need to spend a good part of the initial meetings explaining what we do, why we do it, why it has strong growth and profit and cash flow, and why that's set to continue for the long term. It's a similar pattern recognition. As we get out, as we put up more numbers, as we meet more investors, as people get a familiarity with the business, there'll be a better understanding of the characteristics of the business going forward.
As people look at the investment case and dissect the drivers of the business, these very sticky long-term fees that you've referred to, but there are also performance fees, carried interest, all of which is much more difficult to value. Do you think that in general, investors just wipe that off their calculation and it just sits there as optionality?
The industry has done a lot to reform the way it reports, starting with some of the listed US private equity firms, where there's much more focus on the cash generation rather than what used to be theoretical E&I numbers that used to get baked in. People put in an appropriate haircut to that valuation. And if you look at it on a bifurcated basis, people use a lower multiple or a higher discount rate. And I think that is appropriate to reflect the added uncertainty and volatility of that stream. But as you said, as it from the management perspective of a company, that is hugely valuable cash flow, because as that delivers strong cash-based earnings, that can be used for further acquisitions to help grow the company, for buybacks in the stock, as we just announced one in our year-end results. That source of additional earnings power, even if the market takes a relatively lighter valuation on that versus management fees, is still a very powerful earnings stream from the perspective of managing the business.
And do you think the market struggles that this isn't a typical business with a CEO? Instead, there are three of you, as I understand it, who are running the business in more of a partnership structure. Did you get some pushback? Do you get people scratching their heads a bit about the structure itself?
The aspect on running the firm is actually relatively in keeping with a number of other private equity firms where you might have a multiple partnership structure. And the fact that we've run the business in this form for 15 plus years, I think it's meant that hasn't actually been an area of significant focus. Hopefully people view the business as being relatively well run. The area of focus for us is really about communicating more clearly the earnings power of the business. And where there are questions, it's maybe just making sure that people understand that the board is fully independent and looks out for conflicts of interest or areas of concern that shareholders may have, given it's a relatively distinctive structure.
When you look at your investor base, has it been mostly populated by long-only funds who want exposure to this area and it's more difficult for them to get it? Or is it in fact the alternative managers that buy listed equities that have typically liked your business?
I think there's a mix of both. When we listed, the proportion of long only was, I think, very typical to what you'd see in most other IPOs as well. I think there's a shorthand for the alternative liquid asset managers because they understand the business very well. It's a pretty broad mix in terms of the underlying shareholder base.
And how do you think about your competition?
that switches us from the listed company, Peters Hill Partners, where there is really no other listed business that looks one for one like it, to our broader private equity peers who've operated for the last 10 plus years on the private side. It's been relatively light, but high quality competition. So unlike most areas of private investing, there are some structural barriers to competition because other private equity firms are generally seen as competitors by the firms that we invest in. So a private credit firm or a private equity firm doesn't want another private equity firm coming in and being a large shareholder in their business. The competitive field is relatively distinct for what we do. And the reason is really that most private equity or private credit or infrastructure firms that we're partnering with would view another PE firm as a competitor to them. So it's led to the role of a relatively specialized group, two or three core peers, and between the three or four of us really dominate the majority of the investment activity in this space. We're the only firm today with the listed part of our business. And I think that also brings us several different advantages when we're looking to partner with new firms going forward. The main reason is that for management teams, they want to know that if they're bringing a significant partner to their business, not only is it bringing them the capital they need, and not only is it value added in terms of the resources, but critically, they want to know that that partner is going to be there for the next 10, 15 years. And so this is a long-term partnership structure. The permanent capital that we have through Peters Hill Partners as a listed company is a pretty critical differentiator for us.
If you are kept up at night, what worries you about what could happen in the coming few years?
There's certainly more macro uncertainty today than we've had in the recent past. And I say that despite the fact we've gone through a global pandemic, which wreaked havoc in the economy and where businesses would lose almost all of their revenues overnight. We now have a specter of rising interest rates, inflation, bringing or triggering in different areas, potential recession and other aspects. The way we've looked to build our business is with those possibilities and with cycles in mind. The form we've always taken is both underwriting firms on a relatively conservative basis and looking at firms who we think are nimble enough, have strong enough management to persevere through difficult cycles, but also be highly diversified. Peters Hill Partners is an example that has 23 underlying partner firms. There's no cross-correlation. If one of those firms has an issue, it doesn't impact the brand or reputation of another or the P&L of another. Many of those firms are lock-up capital-based and so have very predictable revenue streams. They're also in that middle market space where they're some of the strongest high-quality firms in their space, and they have the pricing power to be able to raise new capital and operate through difficult markets. And then there are some areas as well, like real estate and real assets, that can benefit from some of the trends that we're seeing playing through the real economy. Certainly a lot of things to be cognizant of, but we've built the business with a view that these things happen, and it's why we call them economic cycles.
So Robert, just before we leave the alternatives business of Goldman's, Peters Hill, clearly, you've described it well, and I think it will be relatively straightforward to understand. But Goldman has a much larger alternatives business. And I wonder whether you could just touch on how both your business fits together with that and generally what Goldman is trying to achieve in the alternative space.
And in some ways, actually, our narrative is a good illustration of how that business has really come together from a communication perspective in the last few years. So we've been operating Peters Hill for the last 15 years. Goldman's been operating in alternatives for significantly longer than that. But historically, that sat within different areas of the firm. So there were some areas of real estate investing, private equity, private credit, liquid alternatives that all sat in different divisions in the firm. And the current leadership under David Solomon have really brought that together, combined it into Goldman Sachs Asset Management. So it's all part of the same division sitting together. And I think that has two benefits. One is it is just easier for shareholders and candidly the market to understand from a communication perspective, because you see the $400 billion plus alternative assets sitting together. And then secondly, it's actually quite helpful for the teams. We're clearly a direct private equity strategy and manage the listed company. And that helps the collaboration with different areas of alternatives. And so it's actually streamlining that over the last few years has certainly made a lot of sense.
I can't leave this podcast without mentioning David Solomon. I actually listened to him being interviewed by Nicolai Tangen, the head of the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, who'd been a guest on the podcast last year. And of course, you have perhaps the only financial services CEO who's also a renowned DJ. Tell me a little bit about how different his approach is from his predecessors.
When you consider the firm overall, there's certainly a lot of continuity, but there's been a greater focus in the last few years on the investor days, on communicating forward strategy to shareholders and the forward direction of the business. And some of those also having relatively significant practical differences. So as I say, bringing all the different areas of alternatives into Goldman Sachs Asset Management was a pretty big structural change in the business. One of those changes that when you look back on it makes a lot of sense. So I think those are some of the initiatives that we've seen come together over the last few years since he's been in charge.
So I've got six more general questions. You're now going to be let off the hook. To quote Sting, you're an Englishman in New York. Give me one of the upsides and one of the downsides.
His song probably overplays the role of New York. New York's obviously a pretty cosmopolitan, global city. You don't get too much attention or difference from being English there. Across the broader US, maybe you do. I love being there. I'm very grateful to my US colleagues and friends for welcoming me. It's a city actually that I've enjoyed partly because it's a great place to work and do business. It's also on the water. As a sailor, it's been highly enjoyable to be able to get on the water pretty quickly from there. So it's been a lot of fun.
And as you think about the next decade, what do you hope lies ahead for you?
We're building a business in an incredible industry, looking to help our partners keep on developing that sector over that time horizon. There are a lot of the firms we're working closely with that we're just putting plans in the ground now that should bear fruit over that decade. Being a part of that and helping to drive some of that is a pretty exciting prospect.
Comparing the US and the UK, what can we in the UK learn about the US in terms of doing business? And is there a vice versa?
I think there are definite benefits on either side of the pond. What I take from the US, it's obviously a very big market, but it's a market that welcomes fresh ideas. And it's part of the reason why the venture and growth community is so big in the US and more limited in Europe. I remember Christopher Hitchens quote talking about feeling like he was wine that would go off in the cask if he stayed in England too long. And that was obviously very particular to his own area. But I think there can be a greater acceptance of new ideas and new opportunities in the US that is certainly very helpful.
If you can have dinner with three of the iconic figures from finance, past and present, who would they be?
David Rubenstein. I've had to follow him on stage at a couple of places, and he's a real polymath, not someone who you shadow easily. Fascinating company and very learned on a range of different fields. Howard Marks, famous for being at asset management CEO lunches and continuing the discussion well after the puddings and wines have been taken away. Maybe Ray Dalio for the unconventional thinking, but also the systematic and programmatic way that he has gone about it and then looked to share that with others for their benefit as well. At the heart of most investment activity is being balanced, being patient, being systematic, and being disciplined. He's a great example of those characteristics.
Interestingly, we've just done an episode with Bridgewater with Ray's right-hand woman, Karen Tambur, who was terrific and spoke to many of those very things about systematic and fundamental combining in a compelling way. Well, Robert, not only have you dragged yourself from your COVID bed to appear today almost completely normal, given that I've met you only once before, so thank you very much for that. But thank you for sharing the Petershill story, because as an investor, I understand that there is this interesting combination of sticky high fees and long duration investments, but I also get the market has fewer comparables to look at when evaluating. And if it was the old Benjamin Graham thinking of weighing versus voting, I think that this may take the market a little time to come to understand, but I'm going to be watching it very closely and I wish you the very best of luck. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much, Simon. Pleasure to see you.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. The 24.4% IRR cited earlier refers to the capital-weighted gross internal rate of return calculated across Peter Hill's flagship vehicles at September 2021, and these funds are closed to new investors. The IRR of Peter's Hill 1, raised in 07, stood at 17.4%, Peter's Hill 2, raised in 2014, at 19.4%, and Peter's Hill 3, raised in 27, stood at 53.4%. Past performance does not guarantee future results, which may vary. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.